The following interviews and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
It's time again for Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio with the latest news and conversation related to firearms and your Second Amendment rights. Sponsored by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Welcome, listeners. Please call in throughout the hour to join us, 458-8255-458-TALK. What is on your mind about firearms today? It's another great day in Fairbanks. The sun is behind the clouds, and the temperature is a whole 1 degree this morning downtown. And here at the KFAR broadcasting station, Melissa is expertly running the board again today. Thank you, Melissa. And she's keeping the Shooter's Corner archives up to date, so if you miss a program, it should be accessible in the archives within 24 hours. I have two announcements before we get started. First, don't forget that you can purchase Joe Nava's book, Not Your Average Joe, a selected autobiography and Joe's wisdom on shooting at our Shooter's Corner sponsor, Frontier Outfitters. And you can usually find the book on the bookcase at the front counter or in back of the store at the gun counter. As always, all the profits from that book go directly to the Joseph A. Nava Memorial Shooting Scholarship Endowment Fund. The books are $20 each, so if you need holiday gifts, you'll be contributing to Joe's scholarship fund at the same time. And those scholarships help the young men and women on the University of Alaska Fairbanks Precision Rifle Team to keep on shooting. Now, last week, Larry Hannison called in the program to remind us to purchase Friends of NRA raffle tickets. And I think he said that they had only sold 300 of the 900 tickets so far, if my recollection is correct. And I want to take a moment to explain why supporting the Friends of NRA local raffles is important. Now, locations around our state, in fact, in all the states, hold Friends of NRA raffle fundraising events as well as fundraising dinners. And the Friends of NRA is part of the NRA Foundation, and that's a non-political 501 charity. And money raised at these local and state events across the nation goes to the NRA Foundation, and a percentage of that is sent back to the states that raised it, the NRA organizations that raised it. And that money returned to the states is what funds many of our local shooting activities. When you purchase a raffle ticket or attend a fundraising dinner, you are sponsoring the shooting sports in your own community. For example, each year I write a grant request to the NRA Foundation for funding of our AIMCOM Youth Marksmanship Rifle and Pistol Program. And we also write another grant request to the NRA Foundation to help us fund the AIMCOM Alaska YHEC, which is the NRA Youth Hunter Education Challenge that we hold here in Fairbanks. And over the years, we have received a great deal of support in both cash and equipment, all due to those of you in our Fairbanks community who have generously purchased raffle tickets and helped raise money at NRA dinners. In the pre-COVID-19 days, you could always count on Larry Hannison and other volunteers being at gun shows, selling the raffle tickets. And now that stopped because of the virus. So they're doing it by person or in-store raffle ticket sales. The past few years, our grants have been awarded for less and less. And the fact is, here in Fairbanks and really all around Alaska, in the past few years, the economy has tightened up. Plus, this year is a disaster with the COVID-19 wrecking family finances and hurting small businesses. There's just less money to spend on raffles. So less money goes to the NRA Foundation, and that means we receive less support for our shooting programs locally. And I'm not complaining at all for our programs. We're grateful for anything at all that we're granted. Whatever it is, it's more than what we had to begin with. But it is expensive to provide quality firearms training programs, especially for our Fairbanks youth. So I wanted to let you know that a portion of the money you do spend on raffle tickets for Friends of NRA events does come back to support us locally. Sportsman's Warehouse has the raffle tickets to sell. You can purchase them there. And you can also contact Larry Hannison directly. It's 907-699-8431. And he will get tickets to you. The tickets are $50 each. The drawing is December 27, 7 p.m. at Sportsman's Warehouse. And you don't need to be present to win. And I also want to personally thank Larry Hannison for all the work he's done over the years to promote the shooting sports in Fairbanks. I've personally learned a lot from Larry, so thank you, Larry Hannison. Again, purchase the tickets at Sportsman's Warehouse or call Larry 907-699-8431. And the local Friends of NRA is also on Facebook. Just Google Friends of NRA Fairbanks Committee Facebook, and the page will come up. So what's on our agenda today? I'll spend this week and a few more weeks talking about Guy Smith's Guns and Control book. I'm finding it a fascinating read. We'll finish up our discussion from last week, which was on Chapter 4, Defensive Gun Use, and then we'll move to Chapter 7, Gun Accidents. And I will wrap today's holiday and history into one with a discussion about Alfred Nobel, who died this day in history, 1896. And I still want to tell you about the Lafayette Washington pistols, which I didn't get to last week, but I'll wait until we have more time in the future to talk about those. So let's get started talking about Alfred Nobel. He died today, December 10th, in 1896. Now, Alfred Nobel is known as a Swedish chemist, engineer, inventor, businessman, philanthropist, and he held 355 patents in his lifetime. And what strikes me is a disparity between Nobel's life's work and the likely unintended consequences of that work compared to how the invested income from his estate champions just the opposite effect. Now, we associate Alfred Nobel with the Nobel Peace Prize. But do you know why Alfred Nobel may have conceived of the Nobel Peace Prize before his death and left his fortune to it? Did you know that Alfred Nobel made his fortune as an arms dealer? More importantly, as the inventor of explosives, dynamite, and weapons that allowed the European countries to arm themselves leading up to World War I. Nobel owned a company, Bofors, and it was originally an iron and steel producer, and he repurposed that company as a major manufacturer of cannons and other armaments. And it seemed Alfred Nobel had good intentions. An 1891 quote from him to the Austrian Countess Bertha von Suttner reads, quote, "Perhaps my factories will put an end to war sooner than your congresses. On the day that two army corps can mutually annihilate each other in a second, all civilized nations will surely recoil with horror and disband their troops," unquote. Now, Nobel had wanted to invent either a machine or produce a material that would be recognized as having such a devastating effect on civilization that no one would go to war. The Australian Countess Bertha von Suttner, with whom Nobel was corresponding, was the first woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She campaigned for disarmament and for leaders of the world to work together to achieve peace. She wrote an anti-war novel, Lay Down Your Arms, which was published in 1899, and it was for this she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1905, so that was after Nobel's death. And passing away in 1896, Alfred Nobel did not get to see his theory disproven during World War I. That was in 1914 to 1918. Armies did blow each other up, and they continued to do that, and they did not learn anything. And I think he was born too early in this world. The atomic bomb is closer to his theory of why humans may stop and think before they annihilate each other. But back to the late 1800s, the story goes that Alfred Nobel did not give serious enough thought to the devastations his weapons would cause. So he did bequeath his immense fortune, a fortune gained from devastating weapons and explosives, to charity. Why did he do this? And I'll tell you right around the break.
Getting out to play in Alaska is a year-round activity. So before you leave home, make sure your trailer is ready to roll. Wheel bearings to wiring and lights. Have it serviced at Arctic RV. Motorhomes, toy haulers, campers, bodywork to appliances. See their huge selection of RV parts as well. Alaska plays rough. Make sure you and your RV are ready for it with Arctic RV. Book your appointment now. Rough it in style. Arctic RV. Open all winter long at 30th and Pegger.
These are dark times in Fairbanks. The sun rises late and it goes to bed early. Most of my driving is done in the dark these days, and I like to have as much light on the road as possible because hitting a moose can be disastrous. Like a lot of Auto Trim Design customers, I rely on moose lights to help me avoid smacking into a swamp monster. We professionally install Vision LED light cannons and LED light bars, also VLED and Pucco LED headlight replacements. Don't live in the dark. Let us light the way. Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
Weather brought to you by The Woodway, your Steel outdoor power equipment dealer for Interior Alaska. See the full line of steel products at The Woodway today. The Alaskan way, the right way, The Woodway.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK and tell us what's on your mind about firearms today. And we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
I got into your show here late this morning, and somebody said that the Donava books were available.
Yes, they are. I was able to get the cases that weren't sold yet, and I took one of them over to Frontier Outfitters. So you can go to, they have a whole case there. It'll either be at the front desk, the bookcase there, or at the gun counter. So, and I can get more if they sell out.
Oh, well, that's great. I've been wanting to get one of these for a few years, so it's like, okay, good.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well,
thanks very much, Laura, for your show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for supporting Joe's Scholarship Fund.
You betcha. Take care.
Okay. So before the break, I asked, why did Nobel leave his fortune to a charity? I read he never spoke publicly about why he made that decision. But the story goes that in 1888, Alfred Nobel's brother, Ludwig, died in France from a heart attack. Quote, thanks to poor reporting, at least one French newspaper believed that it was Alfred who had perished. And it proceeded to write a scathing obituary that branded him a merchant of death who had grown rich by developing new ways to mutilate and kill. The newspaper later retracted their error, but by then Alfred Nobel had read it and began to live with the horror of what might have been his own death notice. This is what he would have been known for, developing new ways to mutilate and kill, unquote. And another quote from a different source said the obituary, quote, went on to describe Nobel as a man who became rich by finding ways to kill more people faster than ever, unquote. And here's one more quote. Quote, the incident may have brought on a crisis of conscience and led him to reevaluate his career, unquote. Now, Nobel's biographer, Ken Font, said that Nobel became so obsessed with his posthumous reputation that he rewrote his last will, bequeathing most of his fortune to a cause upon which no future obituary writer would be able to cast aspersions, unquote. And this is a good tale, and that newspaper article is often cited as the reason behind Nobel's philanthropy. But the reality is that historians have to this day not found a copy of the Merchant of Death obituary. And some historians dismiss the story as a myth, and others say it was a combination of many factors. at that time in Nobel's life that shaped his decision to bequeath his fortune as he did? Nobel himself received an award from the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences for, quote, important inventions for the practical use of mankind, end quote. And some historians say that award might have sparked his interest in starting the Nobel Prize Foundation. Others say Nobel was a voracious reader who spoke five languages and dabbled in writing plays and poems. So some historians think it was possibly this literary interest that influenced Nobel to want to offer prizes for literature. From what I've read, Alfred Nobel was considered a pacifist in his lifetime. A paragraph from the Nobel Prize website reads, quote, there is little doubt that von Suttner's friendship with Alfred Nobel had an impact on the contents of his will, and many give her the credit for his establishment of a peace prize. He said, inform me, convince me, and then I will do something great for the movement, Alfred Nobel said to Bertha von Suttner. That was a quote. I've been thinking about this, and it seems that, at least in modern times, there's been some sort of human reasoning that decides that using firepower is a good way to keep the peace. And I'd have to ask if that has ever worked for the long term. And whatever Alfred Nobel's reasons, a year before his death, he signed his last will and testament, setting aside the majority of his estate to establish the five Nobel Prizes. And perhaps the one prize that might counter his invention of explosives and armaments with which to use them is the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, let's move on. Let's get back to Guy Smith's book, Guns and Control, A Nonpartisan Guide to Understanding Mass Public Shootings, Gun Accidents, Crime, Public Carry, Suicides, Defense, and More. It's a long title. If you missed last week's program, Guy Smith, the author, is the founder of Gun Facts Project. He also maintains a website of the same name, so you can Google that. He claims he takes no institutional money for his work, only small contributions from individuals, which average about $20 each. He does this so he can remain impartial in his analysis of statistics for firearms and related topics. Last week, we got about halfway through our discussion on Chapter 4, which was about defensive gun use. And Melissa keeps the Shooter's Corner archives up to date, so I won't recap. You can listen to the archives. Now, I will quote just two sentences I repeated several times last week that carry a theme through what we've been discussing. And the first is, gun owners only kill a couple hundred criminals a year. And the second is, gun owners use guns for self-defense 2 million times a year. And both of those statements are true, depending how you choose to manipulate the statistics. Now, Smith mentions there is one, what he calls, quote, a sadly lonely orphan of a study, unquote, that claims there are only 65,000 defensive gun uses per year. And he tells us this 65,000 amount is a survey some policy organizations cite because their agenda is to diminish the rate of defensive gun uses, so to discount their possible social benefit. In other words, they want you to believe there are not many defensive gun uses per year, so we don't need to have all those guns owned by the people. Now, occasionally, when I've been trying to put a Shooter's Corner program together, I'll hunt around online to find a gun statistic to provide you, and I rarely come up with anything I can really trust. So all I can do is quote you the statistic from whatever article I found it in. They own that number, not me. Most of these gun statistics we find in articles are purchased through subscriptions to organizations whose job it is to conduct these surveys and provide for a fee gun statistics. There is free data, information, and studies on the Department of Justice website. Google something like, how many cases are there of self-defense with firearms? And I did that, and here's the answer. Quote, these cases are not based on hearsay, but on verifiable reports found through public sources. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Almost every major study on defensive gun use has found that Americans use their firearms defensively between 500,000 and 3 million times each year, unquote. So at the risk of repeating myself, that quote is almost exactly what I provided from the Gun Facts book. And the spread of those numbers, 500,000 to 3 million times a year, should make us weary of conclusions about defensive gun use we read, just in case the writer is biased. Now, Smith provides some charts so we can visualize the trends for the various popular surveys, and they're listed on page 102, and there's a pie chart on page 104 that puts in clear visual perspective the size of each type of defensive gun use compared to the whole. And I'll read you those numbers, but remember, this will not add up to 100%. Because people use multiple methods in an escalating response when they're using their guns for defense. So these are the percentages from the pie chart. And this was an eye-opener for me. Show the gun to the perpetrator. 68.7% of people using their guns for defense do that. Show the gun to the perpetrator. Tell the perpetrator that the respondent had a gun. 37.2%. So more people draw the gun than first warn the bad guy. But I guess that would depend on how fast the victim had to act in that situation. So 68.7% and then 37.2% for telling the perpetrator the respondent had a gun. Pointing the gun at the perpetrator, 32.4%. Firing warning shots, 15.8%. And actually firing at the perpetrator, 15.7%. Capture the perpetrator and hold them until police arrive, 9.4%. Wound or kill the perpetrator, 8%. And use the gun as a club to strike the perpetrator, 1.4%. As the author explains a scenario, I have a gun. Seriously. Here it is. Halt or I'll shoot. Bang. Now, that's four separate actions, four separate defensive gun uses. Since different survey organizations have different agendas and ask questions differently, that statement above can count as one of four or four defensive uses of a gun, or just one, the bang, the killing part. So now we all understand the problem of interpreting what we read. Now here's something else to think about when you're pondering numbers of defensive gun use. Smith tells us we can combine the multiple ways we perform a defensive gun use action into four main categories. First, not actually using the gun. That would be showing or telling or capturing the bad guy. Second, using the gun without firing it. That would be pointing the gun at the bad guy or hitting him over the head with it. Third, this would be firing the gun while not trying to wound or kill the bad guy. And fourth, actually firing directly at the bad guy. Smith points out that if we add up the percentages for all defensive gun use categories that do not have a round fired, the first two categories I mentioned comprised 83%. That is, 83% of all defensive gun uses are done with no attempt by the victim to shoot at the bad guy. And if you add the third category in, the one where shots are fired, but not in an attempt to actually hit the bad guy, that brings us to 91% of defensive gun uses done with no attempt to actually hit the target. So really, roughly only 8% of defensive gun use was actually the victim shooting the perpetrator. And there is something called the uncertainty principle. We don't often think about this when we think about the societal good of having a defensive gun or the perception of having a defensive gun. So let me read a quote from the book. There is yet another insanely unmeasurable kind of defensive gun use, namely crimes not committed because the perpetrator was not willing to take the chance that the victim was armed, unquote. And Smith provides an example. Quote, Think about two houses you might want to burglarize. One has a Prius in the driveway with a coexist bumper sticker, and the other has a Ford pickup truck with a support your local police sticker. Listeners, if you were the burglar, which house would you think might have a firearm for protection? I'd say the house with the Ford pickup truck and the support your local police. That's the house I would not burglarize. And we're going to take a break, and I'll see you right around the corner.
KFAR, the heartbeat of Alaska, now in full stereo at 97.5 FM.
Fox News, I'm Rich Dennison. A Food and Drug Administration committee is meeting today to review an application by Pfizer and its partner BioNTech to begin distribution of its coronavirus vaccine.
The committee is expected to grant an emergency use authorization for the Pfizer vaccine, but it may not be finalized today. Trump administration officials say whenever the approval is given, they can begin administering vaccine within days.
Fox's Eben Brown. Coronavirus deaths in the U.S. are now approaching 290,000. More than 3,100 deaths were reported yesterday, a new record. The number of people filing for new unemployment claims last week was higher than expected.
There were 853,000 new claims. Economists were expecting a slight increase because of delayed filings caused by the Thanksgiving holiday and because of rising coronavirus cases, but the number was higher than forecast.
Fox's Ginny Cassola. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Alaska Department of Law said on Wednesday that the state will not join Texas and 17 other states in an attempt to convince the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the U.S. presidential election. In a written statement provided by Assistant Attorney General Maria Barr, the department said, quote, the narrow timeline prevented Alaska from joining the suit, unquote. Alaskans and all Americans need to know that the national election was a free and fair election. If the opportunity presents itself, the Department of Law will engage with other attorney generals regarding the case, the department said. And finally, Fairbanks police responding to a single vehicle collision on the Stees Highway near Trainer Gate Road early Wednesday morning discovered the vehicle's occupants had been shot. The Newsminer reports, according to a City of Fairbanks news release, the two adult victims were treated at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and are expected to recover. A suspect has been identified but is not named in the news release. Police do not need the public's help in locating the suspect. Police responded and shut down the section of the Stees Highway between the Johansson Expressway and Trainer Gate Road for several hours and used drones to aid in the investigation. That's the latest from the news desk. Have a great day.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Ride into winter with a friend, your Snowway snowplow. Snowway plows are stronger, smarter, the most reliable plow in the industry. Their wireless controls eliminate messy dash installations and provide the ultimate in-cab flexibility. Better yet, Snowway's patented down-pressure hydraulics increase your plowing efficiency by 30%. The drive-in mount system hooks up in seconds, and their structural plow warranty is the best in the business. Stop by Rogers Auto Repair, your Snowway dealer on Dale Road near the airport, or call 479-6665.
Ancient Alaskans survived using tools made with their own bare hands from wood, stone, ivory, and bone. Now, considering they had to collect all that wood, stone, ivory, and bone, dang, that's a full-time job. Aren't you glad all you have to do is drive to Century Hardware? They have already put together hand tools from modern materials. That's how it works. You need a tool? Century has it. Bam! You get your job done. Fast! Century Hardware. What you need right now.
These are dark times in Fairbanks. The sun rises late and it goes to bed early. Most of my driving is done in the dark these days, and I like to have as much light on the road as possible because hitting a moose can be disastrous. Like a lot of Auto Trim Design customers, I rely on moose lights to help me avoid smacking into a swamp monster. We professionally install Vision LED light cannons and LED light bars, also VLED and Pucco LED headlight replacements. Don't live in the dark. Let us light the way. Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner. with Laura Berkowitz. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK. Now, criminologists do go into prisons to conduct inmate surveys, and sometimes the criminologist will select inmates to interview who have nothing to lose by discussing their criminal detail. Now, Smith says criminologists learn a lot about criminal behavior from these incarcerated felons, and importantly, they've learned what criminals think about guns. Specifically, quote, where they get them, what they do with them, how they get rid of them, and how scared they are of them, unquote. And I may have mentioned that I looked at studies on the Department of Justice website, but they were older, and I didn't want to bring you old data. But Smith does talk about an older study, which he says was a landmark study at the time, and subsequent research has not invalidated it. And from the footnotes in the book, the study is The Armed Criminal in America, a survey of incarcerated felons, National Institute of Justice, July 1985, by James Wright and Peter Rossi. In this study, the criminologists covered what criminals were thinking when they were confronting armed victims. Only 10% of incarcerated felons surveyed strongly disagreed with the questions concerning whether it was not smart to deal with armed victims. And these felons were mostly opposed to the statement, quote, most criminals are more worried about meeting an armed victim than they are about running into the police, unquote. Now, Smith says that when averaging responses, 65% of felons agreed with the idea that the possibility or certainty that a victim was armed was something that they, the felons, disliked. And further, the felons thought a lot about this. And Smith summarizes, quote, in other words, two-thirds of thugs think twice if their victim might have a gun, unquote. Now, a few weeks ago, I read an older study on the Department of Justice website that interviewed incarcerated felons who had carried a gun during their crime, and most of them said they did not carry the gun to commit the crime. They carried it to defend themselves against the victim. Now, there's something for us to think about. I guess we are the bad guys to the criminal. So Smith goes on to say, quote, nearly 40% of the surveyed inmates had at some time or another decided not to commit a crime because they either knew or just believed that the victim was armed, unquote. Now, breaking it down further, of the 40% I just mentioned, 69% of them knew other criminals who had been shot at, wounded, captured, or killed by a victim with a gun. So now we know a certain percent of criminals are sizing us up as victims. We might not be a crime of opportunity if we are alert, carry ourselves in a deliberate manner, wear clothes that could conceal a firearm, and what? Drive a Ford pickup, right? So seriously, I want to interject. I'm somewhat appalled when I'm out on the trail and I see runners and walkers in these tight Lycra clothing where the bad guy can unquestionably see that the person has absolutely no firearm or any type of protection on them. Sometimes I just want to stop that person and say, do you know you're making yourself a target? Even if you're not carrying your firearm for protection, at least look and dress like you might be. So Smith points out a quirk in how we measure whether defensive gun use deters crime. He points out that not all states allow people to carry guns publicly, as a matter of course. And even in states like Alaska, where we have constitutional carry, not everyone carries. But all states, even though some make it difficult, do allow people to keep guns in their homes. And it would be difficult to find much meaning in a statistic that, as Smith uses as an example, measures gun availability and defensive gun uses for deterring ATM muggings because, as I just said, not enough people carry. It would not be a relevant data point. But Smith points out that because in all states, people can keep a gun in their home, and according to him, quote, about 73% of defensive gun uses occur either in the home or nearby, End quote. He feels using a gun in the home is a better proxy for whether defensive gun use deters crime. So should we surmise that the burglary rates are lower in states where higher percentages of people have guns in their home? Smith says this does not quite correlate to reality. There are a number of things to think about that affect burglary rates besides whether we are perceived by the criminal to have a gun in the house. And Smith spends some time on this subject, and he has a graphic chart that shows household firearms ownership rate as a percentage of the population of each state as compared to robberies per 100,000 population. And talking about this in depth would take about an hour in itself, so let me give you a broad summary. We cannot draw a conclusion about whether home firearm ownership absolutely decreases burglary rates in a specific state compared to other states without taking into consideration the socioeconomic issues, that's wealth, the geographic issues, population density, weather like snow, and a few other things. And for instance, this chart from the FBI, it's called Crime in the United States 2017. The burglary rates are highly volatile, regardless of whether the state has high or low gun ownership. And this is surprising to me. The worst state for high burglary rates is New Mexico. It has a burglary rate almost five times higher than the best state, which is New York on this chart. That's what surprised me, that New York was the best state on this chart. So let's look at those two examples. New Mexico is a poorer state. It has a low population in a desert climate. It's a border state with unique social issues. New York is a wealthier state. It has a high population, so it has a high density population in many parts, and it has a different set of social issues, and it also has weather conditions there. It does snow there. It does get very cold. And so though New Mexico has a much higher rate of gun ownership than New York, if we compare the two states, New York has the lowest burglary rate of all the states in the nation, and New Mexico has the highest. And Smith says that, quote, up to a certain point, the escalating rate of gun ownership is associated with a flattening of the rate of burglaries. The point at which this divergence becomes a bit weak is where the burglary curve starts to slope downward. Past that point, there is a mixture of moderate and very low population density states ranging from Kentucky to Alaska, unquote. And one conclusion I draw from all this is that if my home is perceived as having a gun, the burglar might go elsewhere, but he might still commit the crime elsewhere. And if I live in a rural state with sparse population, if for some reason very few homes are perceived to have firearms, the burglary rate could still be low because there are simply not that many homes to burglarize, or it can rise because a spread out population can make it easier to perform a burglary. Again, these rates are highly volatile. So Smith says that if we ignore what he calls terrorists, lunatics, and hotheads, that statistics do show career criminals are hesitant to commit a crime against a person they perceived might be armed. Now, this gets back to what's called the uncertainty principle. And Smith defines the uncertainty principle as being uncertain of an outcome. And in the case of a criminal, it is the outcome of possibly being shot by the victim when committing the burglary. So when incarcerated felons are surveyed for these reports, they are asked in separate questions whether they would be concerned about committing the crime if there was a possibility that the victim was armed, as opposed to the criminal was sure the victim was armed. For both questions, the criminals were concerned, and for Smith, this proves the uncertainty principle, that if it looks like you might be armed, that in itself can be a crime deterrent. Now, to deeper analyze the effects of uncertainty on criminals, Smith divides them into fearless criminals and rational criminals. And this is interesting to think about. And I'm taking this right from the book. So it's a long quote, and maybe we should go to a break before I start this, and then we'll do this long quote right at the other side of the break.
Out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only thing to guide you is an evening star. The roughest, toughest man by far was Ragtime Cowboy Joe. He got his name from singing to the cows and sheep. Every night they say he sings the herd to sleep.
In a bass voice rich and deep, crooning soft and low,
he always sings raggedy music.
Getting out to play in Alaska is a year-round activity. So before you leave home, make sure your trailer is ready to roll. Wheel bearings to wiring and lights. Have it serviced at Arctic RV. Motorhomes, toy haulers, campers, bodywork to appliances. See their huge selection of RV parts as well. Alaska plays rough. Make sure you and your RV are ready for it with Arctic RV. Book your appointment now. Rough it in style. Arctic RV. Open all winter long at 30th and Pegger.
These are dark times in Fairbanks. The sun rises late and it goes to bed early. Most of my driving is done in the dark these days, and I like to have as much light on the road as possible because hitting a moose can be disastrous. Like a lot of Auto Trim Design customers, I rely on moose lights to help me avoid smacking into a swamp monster. We professionally install Vision LED light cannons and LED light bars, also VLED and Pucco LED headlight replacements. Don't live in the dark. Let us light the way. Auto Trim Design, 2550 South Cushman.
Weather brought to you by The Woodway, your steel outdoor power equipment dealer for interior Alaska. See the full line of steel products at The Woodway today. The Alaskan way. The right way. The Woodway.
KFAR weather.
You can expect that snow to taper off this afternoon and our temperatures to slowly drop. Today, look for high temperatures right around 2 above. Tonight, we could see some more snow with our lows getting down to near 15 below. Tomorrow for Friday, mostly clear with high temperatures near 5 below. And a quick look at the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, clear with high temperatures near 0 and our lows right around 20 below. This has been a look at your latest Fairbanks area weather forecast.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK. And before I finish up here, let's do something holiday fun. I will give away another one of Gavin De Becker's Gift of Fear books. I don't want us to lose track of what he talks about in that book. So if you call into the program, the first person who calls in will get a copy of that book, and I'll give you instructions when you call in how to do that. Now, getting back to what we were talking about, this is the long quote that I was going to read you. About 26% of felons strongly agreed with the dangers of confronting an armed person, and another 39% agreed but were somewhat troubled. We have a range of 25 to 65%. So if you add the 26 and the 39 together, you get 65%. So we have a range of 26 to 65% of felons who would at least think twice before committing their crime. Some will still commit the crime, but against another victim. Others will not commit the crime, given some other factors. Still more might walk away from a particular type of crime, finding it too dangerous. The ratios are unknown, but we can assume those that strongly agreed that armed victims were troublesome would have overall reduced their criminal activities, at least for their preferred form of crime, and in states where firearm ownership was common, end quote. And by the way, Smith talks in another chapter we'll cover later about public carry, that since 1993, probably until 2017, which seems to be the last year statistics for this book are current, there was a drop in violent crime that coincided with when our nation went from 19 states allowing the public to carry concealed to what we have today. So far, we've been talking about burglaries. Now Smith switches to discussing problems when trying to compare statistics about defensive gun use against crimes committed as it relates to rape and homicide. He notes most rapes are between people who know one another and take place in a setting for which the rapist has permission to be there. This type of situation is more prevalent than an altercation in a dark alley. And because of the close or established relationship between the two people, weapons, that's his word because it includes more than just firearms, are not involved in 85% of rapes. A gun is used in only 3% of rapes, according to Smith. Usually the victim is strong-armed, and Smith says that is so prevalent that the FBI does not break out the weapon type used in rapes in their annual reporting on violent crimes. Now, Smith reports there is an old study from 1979. It's called Rape Victimization in 26 American Cities. It's by the U.S. Department of Justice, M. Joan McDermott. And that showed a woman with a gun or a knife was only successfully raped in 3% of instances. So it sounds to me like having a gun or the knife is a deterrent. Smith points out that comparing a rape situation between two people who know each other when the one or the other has permission to be in the premises is completely different than situations of serial rapists who break into a home or an apartment. Would that serial rapist have a different attitude about breaking in the first place if he thought the female inside had a gun? And that is the uncertainty principle factor that can play out and work in our favor. Now let's talk about homicides. Smith says, quote, "Measuring the degree of defensive gun uses that prevent homicides is hampered by the fact that we cannot know which assaults that were repelled were intended to be homicides. If someone is aggressively breaking down your door before a warning shot scares them off, were they there to commit a hot home invasion, a rape, or a murder? We simply do not know. And even if the victim was certain in their mind, it's not absolute knowledge," unquote. Now, Smith footnotes that in Gary Kleck and Mark Gertz's article, Armed Resistance to Crime, that's in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, fall of 1995, that, quote, "Some victim surveys suggest that of the average 2 million defensive gun uses every year, about 400,000 prevented serious injury or death," unquote. But Smith says that, quote, "that is too vague to know how many defensive gun uses stopped how many intended homicides," unquote. So our takeaway from this part of the discussion is that we can assume that for rapes and homicides, that if the victim has a gun, either the uncertainty principle will kick in and the bad guy will go somewhere else, or if the bad guy tries to follow through with the rape or homicide, the victim may stop the act or prevent it from going further if they are armed. And it isn't as clear-cut statistically as I would like, but we should probably all be armed. Now, next, Smith moves on to robberies and aggravated assaults. And he says that these statistics are much clearer. He provides a chart that compares the use of guns to commit robberies and assaults against the times the guns were used to stop those crimes. And he says, quote, "For both robberies and aggravated assaults, guns are used more or less four times as often to prevent the crime than to commit it," unquote. The next subsection in this chapter on defensive gun use is titled The Spin. And by that, Smith means the political spin. He says the most common type of spin is lowballing of defensive gun use estimates. The large number of surveys on defensive gun use cluster around 2 million defensive gun uses per year. So Smith thinks we can somewhat feel comfortable with this number. And Smith says there is one survey often cited by those who want to make the number of defensive gun uses as low as possible. And that survey is by the National Crime Victimization Survey Group. And it has to do with the way they phrase the questions to the interviewees. And he also points out that certain groups will not acknowledge the deterrent effect or the deterrence effect or the uncertainty principle at play. Meaning, if the criminal thinks the victim has a gun, the criminal will either not perform the crime or go elsewhere. And this has been proven as a real element of defensive gun use. And remember, alerting the criminal you have a firearm, brandishing, firing warning shots, and intentionally wounding in self-defense without killing the criminal all have a deterrent effect. So even though, as Smith points out, it's correct to say guns are numerically rarely used to kill criminals, it is also true, and we need to understand, that both numerically and statistically, elements of defensive gun use are frequently used to prevent crimes without killing the criminal. And that brings us to the end of Chapter 4, Defensive Gun Use. And I think we've had enough heavy statistics conversation for one day. Next week, we'll talk about Chapter 7, Gun Accidents. I know that's a subject that probably all of us are very interested in. And let me hook you into listening to next week's Shooter's Corner with a little gun accident, quote unquote, example from this book. How would you, listeners, classify this incident? And this is right out of the book. I'm quoting. Some bikers were drinking most of the day and one began showing off his gun. Another biker dared him to shoot a beer can off his head. The first inebriated biker did just that successfully. Then the other biker said, "Bet you can't do it again," and you can guess what happened. Is this a gun accident? And how does that get categorized in the gun accident statistics that are fed to the public to sway our thinking one way or the other? And I suspect that there's a lot of gun silliness going on that causes wounds or deaths. And next week, under gun accidents, we'll talk about what the author feels is the statistical truth about how gun accidents for children are reported. And I found this fascinating when I read that chapter, things I had never thought about, how the numbers are skewed up and down to push any political agenda. So what exactly is a gun accident? And we'll visit that next week. I wanted to take a few minutes to tell you about my latest gun magazine obsession. It is Gun Tests, the consumer resource for serious shooters. If any of our listeners have a subscription to that and have been reading it for a long time, please call in and tell the rest of us what you think about it and if you think it's worth subscribing to. I've received 4 issues now, and I do like it. When I started this program, I thought that with the help of my friends, we would do gun reviews on this program. But with COVID-19 and a few other issues, we just have not been able to do that. I do hope we'll be able to do it in the future. So this is the next best thing, this magazine. They test guns and gear, multiple types, makes, models, and write up their results. Now, Gun Tests also has a buyer's guide. The latest one tests 6 brands of speed loaders, and I will share that information with you soon. Actually, I had been wondering about speed loaders, and you know I do use a revolver. I've been wondering about them ever since I was demonstrating to a concealed carry class and accidentally twisted the knob, and my demi rounds embarrassingly went all over the floor. Now, I've worried about that. What if it happens to me in an emergency situation? Now, I have many speed loaders, but the one I like is the 5-star. It's called 5-star. It's an aluminum speed loader, and that came with my Diamond D chest holster rig, and I got that before I found out about 40 Below holsters, and now I use the 40 Below holsters products. So coming up in a future issue, I can't wait for this. The Gun Test people will match up 2 new 2020 Colt Pythons with 2 original Colt Pythons to see, quote, if the new guns are the Walking Dead, that's a good zombie gun, or the magnum force to be reckoned with, unquote. Now, the older pythons will be a 1980 and a 1964, and I'm assuming a 6-inch and a 4 1/4 inch, because the new models they're going to test will be 1 6-inch and 1 4 1/4 inch. So do any of you have older model pythons and one of the newer 2020 models that you can tell us about? There's a lot to share with all of you this winter. And I will see you or talk to you next week. Stay safe.
This has been Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio. Brought to you by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. To listen back to this or past episodes of Shooter's Corner, go to KFARradio.com and click on the archives page. For more Shooter's Corner on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.